Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More tonight in our week-long series on a century of music in New York. We'll dive into a decade that many of you pointed to as a particularly exciting time in New York musical history. And speaking of music history, we'll look at a missing link, a long-lost album by Johnny Cash. His son, the musician and producer John Carter Cash, will tell us the story. And singer-songwriter Dawn Landis will tell us a story or two. She has a fine new album out. It's her sixth, and she'll play some of it live for us. But first, let's hear from you. Our series on 100 Years of Music in New York is an exercise in unabashed musical nostalgia tied to the current issue of New York Magazine, whose annual Yesteryear edition focuses this year on 100 Years of Music in New York. It's broken up by decade, so we've been asking you which decade's music are you nostalgic for?
Despite being born in the early 1980s, it's really the 1970s that I'm nostalgic for. I've delved into this no-wave scene from that era back then, when you had filmmakers making music, sculptors making films, and that kind of fertility in the art scene back then produced some really memorable music. I feel like a track like Rocket USA by a band called Suicide really captures the atmosphere and grittiness of a time that was defined by financial catastrophe in the midst of the Cold War, in the wake of Vietnam, where you really saw things come to a head in the blackout of 1977.
My name is Paul. I'm responding to your question about the most nostalgic music in New York. And I would like to tell you about the punk music. The Ramones, the Heartbreakers, etc., etc. The late 70s into the 80s, mid 70s into the 80s. And to me, that was the most dynamic and original part of New York music history.
Johnny Thunder's band, The Heartbreakers, from 1977. We heard from Paul and before him Alex, both men after my own heart, because that really was an exciting decade in New York music. But you may have other ideas. Send them in at soundcheck.org or on the line at 866-939-1612. And joining me now from New York Magazine is contributor Jennifer Vineyard, and you'll never guess which decade she picked to write about in the magazine and to talk about today. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
So you are nostalgic for the 70s.
Which is a little odd because I was just a toddler back then. It's not like I'm nostalgic for what I personally experienced.
Well, I think we're seeing a lot of that. It's like people are nostalgic for things that they did not actually live through the first time around. Now, I am so old that I did live through the heyday of CBGBs in the 70s. So I'm curious, what is it you think you missed out on back then?
Well, besides the cleaner bathrooms that they may have had back then.
Oh, God, no. No, the bathroom at CBGB's was legendary for all the wrong reasons. So you did not miss out on anything resembling clean.
Okay, because by the time I finally got to go there, it was so scary that you would not go. I mean, as a female,
yeah,
you would not use that bathroom. I mean, it was worse than Coyote Ugly's.
I got to tell you, that was one part of CBGB's that was true to its roots.
Okay.
So, but musically, what?
Okay. Well, I mean, there were all these great bands that were kind of in their beginning stages at that point in time, and they were just figuring out what they were doing. They didn't know necessarily what they were about to become, and they were trying things out on stage for the first time. and sometimes arguing with each other on stage about what song they should play next. Like the Ramones have all these I Don't Wanna type songs.
Right.
Apparently, they don't want to play the I Don't Wanna songs when they're on stage sometimes. And they would just stop the set and argue with each other.
Ain't that you?
Debbie Harry was like figuring out what does she want to do to rip her to shreds. And so she tried like this wedding dress that she apparently had that she had like a tearaway wedding dress. She would tear off other people's clothes. She was just trying to figure out what should be part of the set. How am I a performer? This is a new thing for her.
She's so dope. Come on, rip her to shreds. She's so dope.
So for you, the idea that music was not yet a commodity, it wasn't a finished product, but it's still a kind of a work in process. That's the exciting part.
And to see the inception of so many great bands while they're, you know, they don't know what they're doing. Hilly Crystal is just kind of like, hey, you want to audition? Go on stage and play.
Right. Hilly Crystal, the founder of CBGB's.
Right.
So is it specifically that place and that kind of community of bands that you're nostalgic for?
Well, I think you can fit like Mud Club and Max's Kansas City and some of the other clubs in the area around it. But I think definitely the way Hilly Crystal ran CBGB's and was just kind of like, let's see, and go ahead and try it out. That sounds interesting. And just letting people just do it for the sake of the art of it and not worrying, is this going to pack the club? Am I going to sell X amount of tickets? And you got a lot of great artists coming, probably a lot of really bad ones too, but
Yes. You
got a lot of great artists coming out of that era that, you know, some people only then discovered years later once they were a little more commercialized.
Right. So, for example, Talking Heads, pick a track that for you, you know, sort of summarizes that ethos of that period.
Well, I think Psycho Killer is probably, I mean, because that was one of their first ones. But I picked Life During Wartime just because it references the clubs themselves. And it's about being in Alphabet City in downtown New York at that point in time.
I sleep in the daytime, I work in the nighttime. I might not ever get home. This ain't no party, this ain't no disco. This ain't no fooling around. This ain't the Mud Club for CBGB. I ain't got time for that now.
A little bit of Life During Wartime from the band Talking Heads from their album Fear of Music. They were, of course, part of that amazing scene here in New York in the mid-1970s. And Jennifer Vineyard, contributor to New York Magazine, is with us on Soundcheck. The latest issue's cover story is 100 Years, 100 Songs, 100 Nights, A Century of Pop Music in New York, broken up by decades. And we're asking you, listeners, which decade of New York music you're most nostalgic for. In Jennifer's case, it is the 1970s. What about for you? You can post a comment at soundcheck.org or leave us a voicemail, 866-939-1612. Jennifer, you mentioned the Ramones, Talking Heads.
Blondie.
Debbie Harry has been on the show a number of times. Many years ago, we were talking about this time period. Lower Manhattan in the 70s, and she had this great quote. She said, you know, back then, real estate was garbage, and garbage was everywhere.
Well, she was telling me all these great stories about, you know, actually where the Talking Heads, where Chris and Tina, you know, it's kind of cute in a way. If you have the Talking Heads.
This is Chris
Heads,
France, Tina Weymouth, the rhythm section of the band.
Tina had her Chris, and then Debbie had her Chris.
Chris Stein, the guitarist.
Right. Both of these great, fantastic women musicians had their own little Chris in their bands. But they lived so close to each other and so close to CBGB's that they could see each other's buildings from their rooftops. They all lived kind of in this little triangle area around the Bowery, but their apartments were so horrible. Mm. And they were paying probably about $100 a month in rent. Can you even imagine that?
Yeah.
But they all lived in these kind of dumpy places. And Debbie said her place seemed like it was haunted.
Well, you know, but that's... I mean, how many times have we seen an artistic or musical scene come together because real estate is cheap?
Right.
You know, because there's a place for people to do exactly what you were just talking about, figure out their craft and figure out how they're going to present it.
And she would rifle through the dumpsters to find her costumes for on stage.
Hmm.
I mean, it wasn't until later, like Stephen Sprouse ended up living in her building and helped her design some outfits. But until that point, she would actually go through, she dumpster dive and find things.
So did you do most of the, you know, the artist interviews for the 1970s part of the magazine?
And throughout, you know, some other decades too, but yeah.
But yeah. Sticking with the 70s, let's hear a little bit from Blondie. From their 1978 album, Parallel Lines, this record really catapulted them to another level.
Right, that's why I picked this one, because even though they had some really great songs, Ex-Offender and various things up until this point, this is the one where probably more of everyone else caught on to what was happening in 1970s downtown New York.
And this song has been repurposed in a couple of films ever since. And
name it, they've got a cover of
it. Blondie's One Way or Another. Deborah Harry, Chris Stein, and the rest of the band Blondie from their 1978 album Parallel Lines and the hit One Way or Another. Jennifer Vineyard's with us in the Soundcheck studio, a contributor to New York Magazine, their annual yesteryear issue, their exercise in nostalgia each year, looking back at 100 years of popular music here in New York City, mostly popular music, although Leonard Bernstein is in there and a couple of other classical figures and jazz figures like Wynton Marsalis. And it's decade by decade. Jennifer is here to talk about New York music in the 70s. And we got a comment from Mario from Washington Heights. Mario writes, I have two decades I would love to have experienced for similar reasons. They are the 1930s of Cab Calloway and the late 70s into the 80s disco era. The reason? People seem to have found relief in dancing, even though the economy wasn't the best in the city, which is absolutely true of a lot of the music, even on the punk scene.
Yeah.
You know, people were pogoing up and down. I mean, there was like a sense of release from what was a pretty bleak time here in New York.
Yeah, and so often when I was talking to all these different artists, even from other decades, it seems like if there was a period of time where there was an economic downturn and everyone was poor and struggling, that actually helped create some of the best music.
Now, you did talk to a lot of artists about other artists for this issue. What did Moby have to say about Klaus Nomi? First of all, whose idea was it to put Klaus Nomi, who is still an unknown figure in many circles, in the magazine?
Well, when I got the original list from my editors about who they were considering, I said, what about Klaus Nomi? And then they're like, oh, yeah, let's put him in there.
Okay, so let's tell people who Klaus Nomi was.
Well, since you also are a big Klaus Nomi fan, I mean, you can chime in here, but for some people who may be unfamiliar with him, I would say he was like one of David Bowie's main inspirations, and he was actually in a David Bowie video, for those of you who want to go hunting for that.
And he was one of the backup singers for Bowie when Bowie did his Saturday Night Live sketch performance in 79.
Yeah. Just kind of like a singer and a performance artist, and he kind of was an amalgam of so many different things. And before Lady Gaga wore a lot of her things, Klaus Nomi was like, sometimes he was a Nazi, sometimes he was a vampire, sometimes he was an alien. I mean, he went through all those transformations before Madonna, before Lady Gaga, sometimes before David Bowie, and that's where David Bowie got some of his Ziggy Stardust type inspiration. So,
and he was one of the earliest musicians that I knew of to die of AIDS. So he had a very, very brief time in mm-hmm. the spotlight, mostly in the early 80s, but he was on the scene mm-hmm. in the late 70s.
Yeah.
So what did Moby have to say about him?
He kind of discovered him in a weird way. Like, he was at some movie theater with his mother, and this is as like a...
It's Moby and his mother.
Moby and his mother. Moby was like 12 or 13. He goes to see this... some movie that was showing a whole bunch of little short films before it or after it. And he was sitting there with his mother, and then something with Klaus Nomi came on, and it totally blew his mind. And he's sitting there going, I don't know how I should react. My mom is sitting right here. Like, do I let her know that I really love this and this is what I want to do, or is she going to freak out?
Well, he was someone who could easily freak people out. And musically, he would do everything from covers of Baroque songs from 300 years ago to songs that echoed the dance music of mm-hmm. the day that we were just talking about, like this track from Klaus Nomi called You Don't Own Me.
You don't know me. I'm not just one of your little toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't play with other boys. And don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to say. Please, when I go out with you, don't put me on display. Because you don't know me. Don't try to change.
You Don't Own Me, Klaus Nomi, who was on the scene a brief but shining moment in the New York scene, late 70s, early 80s. Moby writes about Klaus Nomi in the current issue of New York Magazine, about a century of pop music in New York. Jennifer Vineyard, contributor to New York Magazine, with me on Soundcheck, and all this week we are looking back at a century of music in New York, decade by decade. Once again, listeners, which decade of New York music are you most nostalgic for? Give us a comment at soundcheck.org or leave us a voicemail, 866-939-1612. Jennifer, you got a chance to speak to John Cale about Patti Smith. You spoke with Grandmaster Flash, right? About, mm-hmm. you know, there he is trying to think, how do I get this drum break to go on forever?
Yeah.
And, you know, this is like part of the genesis story of hip-hop.
Right. I mean, a lot of it had to do with just him going, okay, if I put my hand on the thing, is that going to break it? And he had to try all these different turntables because there wasn't enough torque. And eventually he found a really cheapo one where it didn't break if he put his hand and started maneuvering it. A lot of trial and error in his bedroom for years. Said he missed out on seeing all what his friends were doing all the time. They'd come to his door, come out and play. No, I can't. Playing with the turntable. And eventually he figured out, this is how I can, you know, loop something. This is how I can break something. This is how I can, you know, seg it from here. He had all these cute names for things, the peekaboo system. But it's just really so he could flip back and forth and manipulate the whole. He almost had to create a whole new science.
So instead of spending, you know, instead of the teenager in his room 10 hours a day with the electric guitar, he's in his room with the turntables mm-hmm. and, you know, becomes just as virtuosic and just as important. Grandmaster Flash's story is one of many in the current issue of New York Magazine. 100 years, 100 songs, 100 nights. Jennifer Vineyard, contributor to New York Magazine, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We want to rock you. We're the kings of swing. We're tilted to rule. The deans of clean. The chiefs of relief can tame a wild beast. The finesse of the west, the masterpiece of the east.
The boss of cars,
the lord of the board.
The ones with the platinum vocal cords.
We're the science of desire,
with a magical mic.
The monarch of the dark in the night of light.
We advertise
and specialize
in the exercise that will energize
the young lady thighs.
Cause all the fly guys
make sense to rise right before their eyes.
We're the earl of the wild
and the heir of flesh.
The duke of death, the mayor of debonair.
Got fine, drink wine,
can dance and die.
Just when you thought you'd heard the last from Johnny Cash, the Man in Black has posthumously released a brand new album, first recorded in the early 1980s. The country icon's son, John Carter Cash, joins us to share some songs from it. And later, singer-songwriter Dawn Landis shares songs from her new album, Bluebird, with an in-studio performance. This is Soundcheck.
how many travelers get weary, bearing both their burdens and their scars. Don't you think they'd love to start all over and fly like eagles out among the stars?
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. To music fans, the idea of the lost album can be intoxicating, but many new releases that are touted as lost albums end up being collections of B-sides, outtakes, and demos. That is not the case with the new album called Out Among the Stars by the late Johnny Cash. He recorded it in 1981 and 1984 during the final years of a contract with Columbia Records. Now, that period was not a high point for Cash, creatively or personally, and his career revival of the late 1990s was many years off. But Out Among the Stars reveals a lot about the man in black. John Carter Cash is the son of Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash and co-producer of Out Among the Stars, which is out this week. John, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me. What a blessing to be here.
Definitely. Wow, what an extraordinary find this is. A complete album.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, you know, it's not odds and sods.
No, it's master recordings.
Yeah. So how was this album lost to begin with?
Well, Columbia Records wasn't that interested in Johnny Cash at the time. But in 1984, which is the majority of the material was recorded then, my dad, I mean, he was at a great point in his life because in the early 1980s, 82, 83, he'd gone through some dark periods. He relapsed into drug addiction. And in late 83, he went through the Betty Ford Center. And while he was there, he wrote this song called I Came to Believe. It was about turning his life over to a higher power. It was his introduction there to the 12-step world and whatnot. When he got out of that that recovery center, early 84, and his life settled back down, and he got reacquainted with his family, and we all came closer together in so many ways. He achieved a prime in spirit. And 10 out of these 12 songs were done during that year.
Mm-hmm.
When I heard this the first time, again, after all these years, because I remember being in the studio a little bit when I was a kid, but when I heard this the first time after all these years, suddenly I was back in contact again with my best friend.
Yeah.
Because that's who he was. So it was a very personal thing.
There's a photo in the liner notes of you and your dad.
Yeah.
With the headphones.
With the headphones around both of our heads, yeah, and close together.
So you knew this album was out there?
Well, you
somewhere?
Know, it's not something that I'd thought that much about. Now, when I heard it again, I remembered being in the studio the day that that Waylon Jennings walked in. And I remembered them recording the song I'm Moving On, the Hank Snow classic that is on this record.
Mr. Fireman, won't you please listen to me? Cause I got a pretty mama in Tennessee. Keep moving me on, keep rolling on. So shovel the coal and let's just rattle and roll and keep moving on.
So I remembered that. My mother and father sang Baby Ride Easy live on stage for years in the early 80s. And they had the vision that that song, Baby Ride Easy, could be a big hit for them. And it's great. I mean, it is. You know, I mean, the energy is there. The spirit's there. And to me, I mean, it's as powerful as Jackson in my own mind.
Well, to me, that song, Baby Ride Easy, it sounds like an attempt to redo If I Were a Carpenter.
Yeah.
You know, the opening,
yeah.
If I Were a Truck Driver,
yeah,
and I Were a Waitress, and I Want a Coffee, and I Poured You Some.
Yeah, yeah.
But let's give people a chance to make up their own minds. Here's a little bit from the lost album by Johnny Cash called Out Among the Stars.
If I drove a truck
and I were a waitress,
and I ordered coffee
and I poured you some,
then you'd stop by on your way sometimes later,
and if we arm wrestled I'd see that you won.
I my baby ride easy, ride high in the saddle all day.
If your lovin' is good
and your cooking ain't greasy, we'll chuck the chuck wagon and we'll ride away.
Some pale senorita
and I a bullfighter way down in the sand, while the band kept on playing that old Cassidore, would you throw me a flower,
would you take my hand.
A little bit of Baby Ride Easy, Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash, and a duet from the newly released lost album by Johnny Cash called Out Among the Stars. John Carter Cash, the son of Johnny and June, is with us in the Soundcheck studio, co-producer of the new album. So your dad goes through this really tough period in the early 80s, comes back, he's in a much better place. You mentioned the song I Came to Believe, which he wrote. Was he still in?
He was in Betty Ford Center when he wrote that song. Yeah, and it was recorded later on in his life when he was working with Rick Rubin for the American Recording Series.
Right.
And it was on one of those records. But this is the first recording of it, you know. And I mean, I don't know, it's personal for me. You know, it is. It's a reconnection.
As it obviously was for him, too.
Yeah.
I mean, and this really is the most personal song on the record. It's called I Came to Believe.
I couldn't manage the problems I brought on myself. And it just made it worse when I laid them on somebody else. So I finally surrendered it all, brought down in despair. I cried out for help, and I felt a warm comforter there. And I came to believe in a power much higher than I came to believe that I needed help to get by.
Johnny Cash, and I Came to Believe. John Carter Cash with me on Soundcheck. That's on the newly released album, the rediscovered album called Out Among the Stars, one of two songs that your dad wrote.
Better on the record,
So did you know that you were even looking for... How did you find this record?
Well, my parents, I mean, they had trouble ever throwing anything away. They were collectors. Mm-hmm. And I won't say that they were hoarders, but they were pack rats.
I noticed the distinct... I could see your internal editor working there.
It was never...
How am I going to finish this sentence?
It was never messy. I mean, my office is messy. But it was never, you know, a mess. But they really... They kept most everything. And through the years, they gathered all kinds of stuff. There was a... in their storage facility, in their office, when they passed away, I had to go through all these things. There was like a camel saddle from Saudi Arabia. There were wax figurines of all the presidents of the United States. I mean, just various objects of bizarre nature, or you know, spiritual, you know, importance, or I mean, old Bibles. I mean, all kinds of stuff. But within this storage facility, there were hundreds and hundreds of audio recordings, 2-inch reels and mixtapes, you know, 1/2-inch reels and 1/4-inch reels, and just, I mean, an amassment of things. We found the original 8-track recordings of the Johnny Cash show, the live television show.
Wow.
Yeah. And sometimes at the end of the night, after the live show, they just keep playing and recording. So I mean, there's a lot of stuff that people haven't heard.
But and anyway, 8-track recordings, so they probably sound pretty good.
Yeah, they sound really good. Yeah, and then also. There was an amassment of music that my dad did in the 70s, just him playing the guitar and singing, which was a lot like the very first American Recordings record. Now, that's been released. That was the personal file that came out on Sony Legacy a few years back. We took all of the reels and we shipped them up to New York to Legacy, which was, I had to bite my fingernails to let them go, you know, okay. I trust you guys, you know, but they transferred everything to digital, working with Greg Geller, Steve Berkowitz, and the guys there at Legacy. They transferred everything and cataloged it all and then shipped the original tapes back to me. But 2 years ago, specifically, we found these recordings, and they just stood out as being, to me, a good Johnny Cash record in its diversity. Made honest statements about my dad's life and who he was, you know, the spontaneity that was there on the record, the fun, the energy, the laughter, which I think is missing from a lot of Johnny Cash stuff.
And it is a kind of a time capsule. You know, as you were alluding to before, this is the sound of country music circa 1984.
Yeah, circa 1984. So, you're going to get that. I mean, it's very true. But in its own way, it's so timeless to me. It's great to hear it now.
Some great songs on the record. And, I mean, right out of the box, track one, the title track.
The title track. Yeah, which, Out Among the Stars can... it being the title to me means so much. It can mean different things. Of course, my father, maybe he's watching from Out Among the Stars. Hopefully, but then again, this song itself, it's a tragedy. It's a powerful song. It lends a powerful message, and it's a story song, which you don't hear that much of, and you didn't hear that much of even back then in the early '80s. Some, but not as much.
And a very keenly observed little slice of life from the writer Adam Mitchell.
Yeah.
And performed by the one and only Johnny Cash.
It's midnight at a liquor store in Texas. Closing time, another day is done. When a boy walks in the door and points a pistol, he can't find a job, but Lord, he's found a gun. He pulls it off with no trace of confrontation. Then he lets the old man run out in the street. Even though he knows they'll come with guns a-blazing, already he can feel a great relief. Oh, how many travelers get weary, bearing both their burdens and their scars. Don't you think they'd love to start all over and fly like eagles out among the stars?
That is Johnny Cash from the Lost and Found album called Out Among the Stars. That is the title track. The album was recorded mostly in 1984, a couple of tracks in 81. John Carter Cash, the son of Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash, found the record as co-producer of the new album. So how much did you have to do with these tapes once you found them?
Well, when my co-producer on the mix, Steve Berkowitz, and I got together, and the great Billy Sherrill was completely retired from the music business.
He's the original producer.
The original producer. But when Steve Berkowitz and I got together and listened to this music, there were holes. I mean, there were things missing. There were guitar solos missing. There would be an electric guitar, but no acoustic guitars, where there probably might have been one had they finished these tracks. And of course, it begged us both to go, why didn't they finish it? But still, they moved on. And my dad did creatively.
Why didn't they finish
it? He would move on from one thing to the next to the next. And Columbia was losing interest. They dropped my dad, right after this. But we were inspired, if we're going to finish this record, what do we do? Do we go straight? What we decided to do is go straight to the source and go as close to as we could to the heart. We called Marty Stewart, who played on the original recordings that were
the guitarist.
Done. Yeah, played the guitarist and the mandolin player on the original stuff. There were other guitar players too, great ones, wonderful musicians all over the record. But we asked Marty, hey, would you like to come back in and replace your guitars? And so Marty actually came into my studio there in Hendersonville, Tennessee, which is the Cash Cabin Studio, which is where my dad did so much of his recordings with Rick Rubin. And Marty replaced his guitars and his mandolin. So it was sort of like coming back around for full circle.
But the point was not to change the overall
sound of those original songs. Yeah, we didn't want to. We wanted to stick with, it worked.
Yeah.
Why change it? I mean, it was beautiful. I mean, it was done by a master with master musicians. I mean, you got Kenny Malone on the drums, who still actually I still work with Kenny some, and Pig Robbins on the piano and Pete Drake. I mean, all these great musicians that were on the original recording. So you didn't have to replace any of that. But it wasn't. There was a few things that we did subtract here and there, but not much. We tried to stay true. There's one song where there's a lot of new music, and there's only one. It's the Don't You Think It's Come Our Time is more of a bluegrass Appalachian kind of feel now, and originally wasn't that way. But for the most part, the record is in place as it was originally produced.
There is one major exception to that, which is a version of She Used to Love Me a Lot. Let me play for folks the version that your dad recorded.
Uh-huh.
And then we can talk about what happens to it when Elvis Costello gets his hands on it. This is the original from the Johnny Cash album called Out Among the Stars.
She used to love me a lot. I sat down beside her and she smiled. She said, "Where have you been? It's been a while." She was glad to see me. I could almost read her thoughts. She used to love me a lot.
So that's the original version of She Used to Love Me a Lot.
Yeah, that's the record mix, which we sort of called the haunted version. Yeah.
So what did you do with it?
Well, Steve Berkowitz and I were talking, and we were like, because we were back and forth on two mixes. So we settled on the one, and then we said, well, why don't we go even farther out then? And let's call an old friend who was a dear friend of Steve's and a friend of mine and the family's for years. And he was a friend of my dad's back in the early 80s, and it actually worked with producer Billy Sherrill, and that man is Elvis Costello. We called Elvis and asked him if he would be interested to do a mix, and he was excited to produce a unique mix. And we said, "Why don't you just go for it? Just do whatever you feel, you know, that your heart leads you to do with this song." And the result is sort of magical.
It's a kind of a bonus track on the album by Johnny Cash, the recently rediscovered "Out Among the Stars."
She used to love me a lot. I sat down beside her and she smiled. She said, "Where have you been? It's been a while." She was glad to see me. I could almost read her thoughts. She used to love me.
Elvis Costello produced that arrangement of She Used to Love Me a Lot. Yeah, I mean, John, it just kind of shows a good song stays a good song.
Oh, yeah, it does.
I mean, those are two radically different approaches.
Well, that's it, and the man singing it, that's, you know, that really is what matters. My dad would hold a little 57 microphone, which is just a little cheap, you know, $125 microphone, sing into it. He'd sound just as good as he would through a $10,000 microphone. You know, that's the magic.
We're speaking with John Carter Cash, the son of Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash. He's a co-producer of the new album, Out Among the Stars, an album that his dad recorded in the early 80s and is being heard for the first time ever this week. Again, not a collection of outtakes or demos, a genuine record that was made, almost completed, never released.
Right. Yeah.
Is there more stuff like that out there?
There is. There is more music. There are more complete records out there.
Really?
Yeah. But, you know, it's got to be just right. It has to fit certain criteria. And it's got to be something that in my heart and that the trust that we feel is what he would do, something that he would want, you know, released. And this fits that criteria. There will be other things coming out, but we're really taking our time.
All right. Well, the current one is called Out Among the Stars. And John Carter Cash, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here, John.
Mama, I guess you heard I got married in Tennessee. I got a blue-eyed girl who thinks the world of me. We got a cabin in the country and the creek that rolls nearby, and the dog that won't even bark at a firefly. Our clotheslines hang just outside our back door, and there's a tire that swings in the air 10 feet or more. There's a church I can't seem to find on Sunday morn, but I sure found the place that I belong in.
Don Landis has a new album. It's called Bluebird, and fortunately it hasn't been lost in the red tape of the music industry. She and her band will join us next to play some songs from it live in the Soundcheck studio.
Looking for clearer skies, I found
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The first Bluebird of spring has arrived here in New York. Bluebird is the name of the new record by the Brooklyn-based singer-songwriter Dawn Landis. The album is her sixth, and it has a light, subtle sound that contrasts a bit with some of her other recent releases. For example, that EP she did of French Yeye tunes, or an album of Serge Gainsbourg-like songs. Dawn Landis and her band today join us here in our studio to play some of the tracks off this new record called Bluebird. This first one is the title track, Bluebird, from Dawn Landis and Company.
Sweet song, lead me on. I just wanna follow you. Oh, blue.
That is Dawn Landis and her band live on Soundcheck with the title track from Dawn's latest release, her sixth. It's called Bluebird. And it featured Don Landis singing and playing guitar, with Kyle Sanna also playing guitar. Annie Nero backing vocals, Thomas Bartlett at our piano, actually doing a kind of muted piano thing to provide the percussion there, and Tony Scher playing the double bass. Boy, this is a band that is lousy with songwriters. It's like everybody here is like...
I like the word lousy as opposed to rife.
It's good to hear you singing in English again.
Oh, thank you.
Last time you were here was the French project.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So this song, Bluebird, and this album of the same name, it kind of has a winter into spring quality somehow. At least that's how I hear it. Hmm. Maybe it's a function of it being the end of winter, beginning of spring.
Yeah. But there was sort of an emotional thawing happening.
Yeah. So what, I mean, is it about that kind of sense of things opening up again after having been kind of iced over and closed down for a while?
Yeah. I like that metaphor. I think that's good. Yeah. I didn't really have a, you know, it kind of all just arrived as they do from the gods or from the atmosphere, or, you know.
the image of birds, was that something? Because on your website, if you look for your bio, it, you know, where you expect to see Don Landis was born in Kentucky, went to, you know, New York, whatever, we get the T.S. Eliot poem, Burnt Norton, which includes the line, "Go, go, go, said the bird, humankind cannot bear very much reality."
Yeah.
That's your bio,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, why not, right?
What does that line mean to you?
Wow. I don't know. I love T.S. Eliot. I love that he was a banker, you know. I don't know. His whole thing appeals to me.
Yeah. The idea that somebody could both be a poet and sort of be, like, immersed in the minutiae of day-to-day living as a banker.
Yeah, I just feel like he's down in the trenches, sort of.
Well, you know, and then there's Charles Ives, the American composer who was also an insurance executive.
I did not know that.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes, considered to be like one of the fathers of the American insurance industry, but also, obviously, important American composer.
That's incredible.
So it does happen. So these songs, are they coming from a kind of autobiographical place or, you know, do you not write real confessional stuff?
I think there's sort of a grain of confession in every song or every idea, but mostly what my process seems to be, I have one image for a song, and then that's sort of like the seed of the song, and then the rest of it kind of grows around the seed. So,
and so this album, are all those seeds kind of related, or is it just kind of scattershot?
Thomas, do you have Thomas
the album. Co-produced the record. Yes.
I think he was helpful in picking the garden for this one.
Well, it's also, you know, the sound of this record is, at first glance, it's very sparse, kind of spare, and then you realize, well, actually, there's a fair amount going on.
Right. A lot of the finger-picking stuff I'm doing on the guitar is really rhythmic, and there aren't a lot of drums. There's one song with drums on this whole album, so all the percussive stuff is happening in other, sort of welling up in other places.
Mm. Now, in addition to writing all of these songs yourself, you also recorded a track for the new Bob Dylan in the 80s record.
Yeah.
Did you get to pick the track, or were you assigned it?
I did. Well, it was a friend, Jesse, who's producing this album. When he mentioned Dylan in the 80s, that was the first song that came to my mind, Dark Eyes.
Dark Eyes.
Yeah.
Are you a fan of Dylan in the 80s?
I'm actually not that well-versed in it, to be honest, but
because I think the whole point of this project is
to rediscover
the
stuff
people
from
think
that
Dylan
era
in the 80s.
Right. Yeah. But I was excited because I got to sing it with Bonnie Prince Billy, and he's a fellow Kentuckian, and I'm a big fan of his work, so that was exciting.
So Bluebird is the name of the record. It is out now, and the song "Try to Make a Fire Burn Again." There's something. If you just read the lyrics, they seem kind of provocative in a chiding sort of way. You know, don't you want to mistreat me and make a fire burning? But in the delivery, it becomes a little more complex than that, it seems.
I think it's a complex emotion. It's sort of like a pushing and a pulling at the same time. That sort of stasis of indecision and, you know, desire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You want to play it for us?
Sure.
All right. Dawn Landis is my guest here in the Soundcheck studio. This song called Try to Make a Fire Burn Again comes from her latest album. It's her sixth. It's called Bluebird. And we'll hear it performed now with Dawn picking up the guitar once again. And again, Annie Nero on backing vocals. Kyle Sanna also playing guitar. Thomas Bartlett is once again at our piano. Thomas co-produced Bluebird, the latest from Dawn Landis. Tony Scher playing the upright bass. As I mentioned earlier, this is an ensemble full of gifted musicians who are songwriters in their own right, but they're all here playing with Dawn Landis, who is tuned and ready to go. Here's the song, Try to Make a Fire Burn Again.
I don't lie, I just get by. I'm not gonna try to understand. Give it away every day. I don't think I'm gonna understand. Ooh, getting out of hand. Don't you wanna love me?
Very nice. Try to Make a Fire Burn Again is the name of that song. Dawn Landis and her band live on Soundcheck. The album is called Bluebird. It is out now. Well, now, you do have a song called Lullaby for Tony, and which is not the only time you've used the lullaby term in these songs. WNYC, we're doing a station-wide project on sleep. So do you have music that you use to kind of lull yourself to sleep at night or some other sound?
My brain works the other way. A fan. I like white noise. I have to have a fan on. But if I hear music or any hint of melody, my brain just wants to dissect it and figure it out and repeat it ad infinitum, you know?
I'm exactly the same way.
Yeah.
Cannot go to sleep if there's anything vaguely musical on. Mm-hmm. Rain, on the other hand, I'm out like that. So for you, it's like...
I was a big fan of dryers, washer dryer noise, and white noise of any kind.
Have you seen the online apps
for people to fall asleep. Some of them are actually washer dryer is one of them. Actually, there's like several models.
I need to get that.
It's crazy. I had no idea, but yeah.
Yeah, and have you seen the Sleep Talk app?
No,
what's
that?
You can record yourself talking in your sleep. It's pretty amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's potentially quite disturbing.
And you can also listen to people the world over talking in their sleep. I heard someone from China. I heard someone from, and it's funny when you hear the accent too. It's really nice.
So wait, instead of sleeping, you're tuned in to hear what other people are saying in their sleep?
Exactly. Insomnia does weird things to you.
I think we've just hit on the seventh Don Landis record. A concept album of overheard sleep talking.
So I like that idea.
All right. You're welcome. Don Landis, thank you so much for coming in
Thanks
and playing for us.
This is fun.
The album's called Bluebird. It is out now. Don Landis with us on Soundcheck.
Hard I try, pain lingers. Our love's gone dry like grease on my fingers. To meet a reason why, just pull out the stingers. I'm not gonna.
If you like this session with Don Landis, you can download it, along with podcasts of most of our other sessions, for free. Just go to soundcheck.org or subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. Tomorrow on the show, all this week, as you know, we've been talking about the ways in which we're nostalgic for bygone eras of New York music. And tomorrow we'll conclude the series with a look back at the 1940s with New York Magazine contributing editor Mark Jacobson. And we'll ask a psychologist why we get nostalgic and why music in particular seems to trigger such powerful memories. Also tomorrow, the singer Sabina, frontwoman of The Brazilian Girls, joins us to play songs from her latest solo album. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.